It's episode 6 of season 2 of Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. I'm Peter Moore. Today we're going to be talking about conscription, about the striking public reaction to the Battle of the Somme, and about the eventual fall of the Prime Minister Herbert Asquith. The year, of course, is 1916. When the former mess steward Florence Green died in 2012, a few days short of her 111th birthday, our last living connection with World War I was severed. The horrors of that time passed into history. But while lived experiences have gone, scenes from that time remain vivid. We can instantly conjure up pictures of the trenches, of the mud and of machine guns. It still seems, as Woodrow Wilson put it a century ago, a war to end all wars. Over the past decade, the journalist and historian Simon Heffer has been working on a series of books that tell the story of modern Britain. High Minds and The Age of Decadence guide the story from the 1840s to 1914, and his hugely ambitious and intensively researched new book, Staring at God, covers the years of the Great War. Simon is Professor of Modern British History at the University of Buckingham. He's spent 35 years as a journalist on Fleet Street, working as a deputy editor of The Telegraph and Spectator. I met Simon the other day at his publisher's in London to talk about a year at the heart of World War I. We always ask our guests to pick a specific year so we can look at history at close range. And your book is already pretty concentrated anyway. You look at 1914 to 1918. Today's episode, you picked a year right in the middle, 1916. So my first question to you is, can you begin by outlining the political and military reality as 1916 begun?
Well, the British Empire, which is fighting this war as the ally of the French, isn't doing tremendously well. There's stalemate on the Western Front. It's not the campaigning season, but 1915 has been a bad year. We've had a reverse at the Battle of Loos on the Western Front. Earlier in the year, we had a very bad time at the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle. And in the spring, of course, there was the Dardanelles debacle, which was brought a temporary end to Winston Churchill's career as a cabinet minister. But the big problem that faces the government, and by this stage it's a coalition government, led by a liberal, Herbert Henry Asquith, but with a big conservative element in it. The government is having an argument about conscription, because men are being killed in far larger numbers than anyone had imagined would be the case before the war broke out. This is, after all, the first big mechanized war in history. And every time a man is killed, he needs to be replaced. And they are relying on volunteers at this stage. There's tremendous social pressure to volunteer. There are recruitment posters that seek to humiliate men all over the country. Most famous is, what did you do in the Great War, Daddy? A man looking very shifty, sitting in an armchair.
That's where the daughter sat on his knee and his son playing shoulders on the floor.
That's right, and he obviously hasn't done his bit.
Mm.
And by early 1916, over 2 million men have volunteered. And we had a standing army already of about 400,000. But it's not enough because men are being killed so rapidly. So there's a huge argument going on about whether men should be conscripted. And Asquith, as a traditional liberal, doesn't believe in state intervention in the lives of ordinary people. And therefore, he doesn't believe that there should be conscription. He doesn't believe that men should be forced to fight for their country. And he has this argument with mainly with the conservatives in his cabinet, but also with Lloyd George, who, although a liberal like him, is somebody who, as Minister of Munitions, is perhaps more aware of how intense the fighting is on the Western Front and the rate of attrition.
Yeah.
And he tries to convince Asquith that conscription is necessary. Asquith has although he was a very good peacetime Prime Minister and had much on his plate in the 6 years before the war when he was Prime Minister, he has never really adapted in the first 18 months or so of the war to wartime conditions. He doesn't understand that in a state of total war, government and the role of government and the way that government affects the lives of individuals has to change. So that debate is still raging on the 1st of January 1916, but very soon there's a big departure from precedent, and all single men under the age of 41, above the age of 18, who are medically fit and who are not in a reserved occupation are told they have to go and fight for the king against the Kaiser.
Well, we'll pick up those themes in a moment, because I think you've introduced one or two of the topics that we're going to look at in a little bit more detail in a moment. But just first of all, on tone, you started off by talking about a few of the military debacles of 1915. And these stats are well known now, but they still strike you as enormous. So just in May 1915, for example, we're talking about a number of casualties which almost rivaled that in the Second Boer War. Okay. And the Times is publishing lists all the time of the numbers of wounded and so on. And if we play that against what everyone knows or thinks of as the summer of 1914, which was a very different time. There was a great deal of optimism about the war. In fact, it was a war that a lot of people didn't see coming. You talk at the start of the book about the concerns of the newspapers during the summer of 1914, and it's, you know, it's quite trivial things about horns going off in the streets.
The service problem.
Yeah, this kind of thing. But yeah. I was thinking, so by the end of 1915, which is where we're poised to begin our discussion today, has the tone changed completely? Has that original optimism disappeared completely?
The optimism goes quite early on. It goes actually after the retreat from Mons in August 1914, a report of which appears uncensored, more or less, in the newspapers at the very end of August and shocks people. What they don't really understand is a war that's being fought between armies. Because the expectation, and this is why people thought the war would be over by Christmas 1914, the expectation was that our navy, which was the biggest and most powerful in the world, would simply wait for the Germans to come out into the North Sea and annihilate them. And once Germany had no navy, it would starve very quickly, because no shipping would be able to get through to deliver food to it. And German naval power was second only to ours, really, in the world. We thought that once we'd conquered that, it would be all over. As it was, the German Navy didn't come out of port really until the summer of 1916, the Battle of Jutland, which was, although a score draw for us, it had such an impact on the German fleet, which also thought it was invincible, that they didn't come out of port again. So the war had not begun in the way that people had expected it to begin.
Okay.
And they were amazed at how quickly what the army that the Kaiser called the Old Contemptibles, or they called themselves that after he called them the Contemptible Little Army, that went out to France, how quickly it was either killed or wounded and brought back broken. And that's why they needed this enormous number of conscripts
right.
to replace it.
Well, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think some of the very first words that you write in the book is that this is not a military history. You're
that's
concerned
right.
chiefly with events in Britain during this
yes.
time and how the war kind of was refracted back, I suppose.
Yeah.
And some things to note of real importance. You've got these Zeppelin raids, which are, you know, kind of probing further into Britain,
yeah.
aren't they? Especially London, but other places as well. And then you've got this very, I suppose, divisive event with the trial and conviction of Edith Cavell,
yes.
which really you use as probably the chief example of what, again, you term as German frightfulness.
Well, it's not a term I use, it's what the public talked about at the time. This was a great propaganda war right from the word go. There was a propaganda unit set up by the government in the autumn of 1914, and they invited many of the great literary figures of the day, you know, H.G. Wells, Conan Doyle, John Galsworthy, etc., etc., were invited to come and make a contribution to it. It was largely run by Henry Newbolt, the poet who wrote the thing about, you know, play up and play the game. And when Edith Cavell was executed by the Germans in October 1915, she was a nurse, of course, and they accused her of spying. She had unquestionably been helping some prisoners on our side to escape from Brussels. And the spasm of outrage that this triggered, even without any propagandistic spin put on it, was enormous. And it was a fundamental event in British life when the word of her execution got here. It was then propagandized very seriously. about typifying the wickedness of the Hun, of German frightfulness. But it had such a lasting effect that in 1919, and this is almost the last thing in my book, in the spring of 1919, her body was repatriated. And it arrived by ship at Dover, travelled from Dover to London on the train, where there was a memorial service in Westminster. And then there was a procession through London to Liverpool Street Station, where it was taken back to her home city of Norwich, where she was buried in the cathedral. And the railway line was lined all the way from Dover to London. The streets of London were lined where her procession went. And the railway line from London to Norwich was lined as well by people, almost unbroken all the way. That was the effect that the murder of this harmless woman had had on British public opinion.
But you're talking about an event that happened in 1919. So I suppose if we go back to the latter days of 1950s...
I'm just saying the effect was so profound that it was still felt. It was still resonating in society after the armistice.
Yeah.
So yes, by the end of 1915, which is only 2 months after she's been executed, there is great hatred for the Germans. They are regarded as bestial.
Yeah, so I think all this plays very well into our, I suppose, description of what the tone was like in Great Britain as 1916 began. I should probably point out as well that Winston Churchill was resigning. There's government unrest. But mind you, Winston Churchill always seemed to be resigning
He resigned in November and had gone to join his regiment as a colonel on the Western Front.
Okay.
But I mean, to answer your point about tone, the main tone at the start of 1916, I think, was one increasingly of disbelief. The disbelief that the war had gone on this long and that society had changed so much that there were virtually no young men around by the middle of 1916. They'd all been either volunteered or had, from 1916, were conscripted into the army and they were being taken out of society.
Yeah, I remember there's a quote from Vera Brittain when she writes, "There was no one left to dance with," which is a very simple but evocative way of describing the dynamics in society, which was strangely off-kilter at that time. The balance had gone, hadn't it?
And women's life was changing too. I mean, most women who worked before the Great War were in domestic service. They were below stairs. And they realised when the war broke out, not only that they could do something useful for their country by going and working in a munitions factory or in a clothing factory or on the land as land girls. Everybody thinks the Women's Land Army started in the Second World War, didn't it? Started in the Great War. And so they came up from downstairs, they came out of domestic service, and they went into these factories. And this transformed the role of women. They became more independent. They had more money. They had money to spend on themselves for the first time in many cases. They were no longer servile. They were no longer, in these cases, reliant on a master or mistress in the house to tell them what to do. They were no longer, if you like, infantilized. And women had been campaigning for many years for the vote. And it's in 1916 that finally Asquith agrees that they have to have it, because without women, the war would have been lost.
Well, imagine that going on to one side as we hurtle into our first scene, because this is the date I want to get to. So it's the 27th of January 1916, the Labour Conference in Bristol. It's an important day and it's an important place. Could you tell us what's happening there?
This is the Labour Party's discussion about accepting conscription. And the Labour movement, like the Liberal Party, have not wanted the coercion of individuals to go and fight. And there's been industrial unrest in 1915 in Glasgow. At the very end of 1915, Lloyd George is howled down in Glasgow when he goes to address a meeting of trade unionists. And the impression is given by the right-wing press, and I say that because much of it's owned by Lord Northcliffe, that the working-class movement is not patriotic. But the Labour Party actually is full of very patriotic people, particularly its leadership, people like Arthur Henderson. And they are determined that they are going to do their bit in the war. They agree to conscription. Henderson is part of this coalition government. He's the main Labour representative in it. And they are determined that they're going to do their bit and that the working class is not going to be found wanting.
So would he have been one of the key players on that day in that place in Bristol when the conference took a vote? Because it seems to me incredibly important what happened, because I think the mechanics of it are that they didn't agree to go along. They voted against the Conscription Act, but they also voted that they weren't going to oppose it. So it was a bit of a, it was almost a bit like Labour Party Brexit policy.
They very much so. They weren't going to stand in the way. I mean, it was the de facto acceptance of what the government was doing. The Labour movement was very keen not to be tarred with the brush of either defeatism or not doing its bit for the war. They did feel damaged by what had happened on Red Clyde's side, which was where shipbuilders, who were in many cases so drunk they're only working 3 days a week, were saying they weren't going to pull their finger out. Lloyd George, you know, had said in the previous year that he was fighting three enemies, the Germans, the Austrians and drink. And the working class were very angry at being tarred with that brush. And it all contributed to a determination to do what they could. But of course, you know, a large proportion of those men who'd volunteered already were working class men.
Well, let's talk about conscription a bit, because I think it's, for me, it came across as a fascinating, I suppose, conflict for Asquith in particular. So we're talking about a liberal prime minister. And the problem was that to conscript people into the army is a fundamentally illiberal thing to do. Well, this was, this seemed to be the personal problem that he had with it. So I know you get to the point towards the end when you, I think, is it H.G. Wells says, the rediscovery of the state, this is conscription, is the rediscovery of the state as a necessary form into which the individual life must fit. But that was a place it took quite a long time to get to. This idea of telling people you have to go off and serve rather than volunteer was tricky, wasn't it?
The purpose of conscription was not settled in terms of single men until January 1916, by which stage the war's been going on for almost 18 months. But that is because they've run out of men to send for training, and even Asquith, to his great regret and reluctance, has to admit that without conscripting men, they won't be able to fight a war against the Germans. So they have, if you like, to emulate the Prussian state. The Prussian state has always made the individual subservient to it. Prussian militarism has thrived on a form of conscription ever since the time of Frederick the Great.
I think there's a slight dovetailing here with this frightfulness of the Prussians we were talking about before, that if we start conscripting, then we're kind of just as bad as they. Yeah.
But this is a sign that the war has become existentialist. This is a, you know, in the early months of the war, there's all this fear, particularly as Zeppelin raids start, that the Germans are about to invade. That's never going to happen because our navy is too strong to allow them to invade. But they can, if they want to, wipe out a very large chunk of our manhood. And they do that, indeed. They kill 750 or 1,000 or so British men during the war. They can also, and they try this in 1917 with their U-boats, try and starve us into submission. And so the way of life of this country is under threat. The liberties of this country are now seen to be under threat. Because obviously if we were starved into submission, some sort of revolution would have happened here, as happened in Germany when Germany was starved into submission in 1918. So the politicians are sensible enough to realise that defeat will bring the complete end of the social order. I mean, the social order is radically changed anyway by the war. And by 1916, it's already changed in the nature of the role of women in society and also the level to which the state interferes through the Defence of the Realm Act in people's lives. But if we'd lost the war because of a shortage of men or for whatever other reason, then there would have been a total upheaval here.
So the dilemma, politically, as I see it, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you just, it's a simple, you know, mathematical equation. You need to find ways of replacing the fallen on the continent. The problem with that as well, which is an extension of what we've been talking about, is if you're taking healthy working men away from the workforce, then what effect is that going to have on communities, and what effect is it going to have, probably more of concern to them, on productivity? Because there's this idea that the Germans are much more productive, and if you're going to be taking people out of mines and away from the shipyards and sending them off to the trenches, then that's going to cause problem. And then at the same time, as a, I suppose, side issue to this, you talk about the problems on the Clyde, which is where the labour movement is quite strong, and there's this terrible fear of a general strike, isn't there?
Yes, I mean, the Clyde isn't so much the labour movement, it's almost Bolshevism before Bolshevism asserts itself properly in Russia. The people on the Clyde don't see the war as an opportunity for them to serve their country. They see it as an opportunity to overthrow the ruling class. And they want to deter working class men from fighting because they say all you're doing is going and killing other working class men who are fighting unwillingly on behalf of great empires, great emperors, great aristocracies. around Europe. And well, there's an element of truth in that. But it's less true in this country, where there isn't that feudal dependence on an emperor or a feudal dependence on an aristocracy that you perhaps have in Prussia, or you certainly had in Russia at that time. That people have got much more of a stake in society. Almost all men have got the vote. No woman has the vote, of course, but almost all men have got the vote. So there's a stake in society here. And it's why the rhetoric of the working class leaders in places like Clydeside doesn't entirely ring true. But there are many other trade unionists who just want to exploit the situation, that there's a scarcity of labour, and they can therefore or should be charging more for theirs. But, I mean, to go back to the point about productivity, yes, the Germans have better machinery. They've overtaken us economically 20 years earlier. And Lloyd George is rather shocked when he becomes munitions minister in 1915 by just how rudimentary the production of arms and ammunition is in this country. By 1916, it's starting to be modernised. He's opened national weapons factories, and he's also seen, he's got engineers in to see that the engineering process can be speeded up. So the fact that the men who traditionally worked in the very limited number of arms factories we had in the time of peace have been largely replaced by women isn't a problem, because those women are soon trained. They're just as able as men. Their brains are just as capable as men's brains of learning what to do. And the machinery of production is improving constantly. So by the time of the Battle of the Somme, we're producing just as many arms, as many weapons as the Germans are.
So let's pick up on Lloyd George, because there's a few central figures who are particularly important to this conscription debate. Lloyd George is advocating for conscription as early as, I don't know, mid-1915,
yeah.
Isn't he?
Yeah.
And he's in the press doing so, and he's seen as a more dynamic and energetic leader as a result. And that is obviously in contrast with Asquith, the Prime Minister, who's dithering, isn't he? He's not quite sure. I think he's fundamentally against the idea. But he doesn't seem to, we can talk about him later, but he's a committee man, isn't he? And he doesn't really give clear leadership on this issue.
Well, Asquith does never adjust to the realities of war and what war requires. And he's up against, or they're meant to be on the same side in more ways than one, he's up against Lloyd George, who sees the creation of a coalition in May 1915 as a real job opportunity for him. He's been Chancellor of the Exchequer by that stage for 7 years. He's not been a very good Chancellor. He is looking forward to a change. And he also sees it in a coalition government in which the Conservatives have quite a lot of time for him. They see he is a very capable politician in terms of being able to communicate with the people. He sees his opportunity possibly when Asquith goes taking over from him. And one reason he is so much in favour of conscription is it wins him brownie points among all his Conservative colleagues, whose support he will need.
Churchill's a good example, isn't it?
Churchill's a very good example.
Yeah.
Churchill, of course, was a Liberal then, but he was in the Liberal Party. He'd left the Conservative Party in 1904. But the people who really clocked on to Lloyd George and began to support him, even though they didn't like him personally, were Bonar and Curzon, and also Balfour, who was the former leader. These are three serious Tory grandees who think, well, you know, he's not a nice man, but he's a man who can get things done, and we need someone who can get things done. In the opening weeks of the war, Asquith, when he got a little bit flustered, would go and sit in the Athenaeum, his club in London, and read a novel in the afternoons, which, I mean, just defies belief. He spent many cabinet meetings writing to Venetia Stanley, who wasn't his mistress, but who he very much hoped would one day become his mistress. So he never engaged with the realities of war, and so by early 1916, he's fighting a losing battle to keep what he regards as liberal principles at the forefront of the conduct of policy in Britain. And having conscription violates a fundamental liberal principle.
And the third character, if we've dealt with Lloyd George and Asquith, that is just there so often, as I was reading through these chapters, is Northcliffe, who you describe,
yeah,
as a megalomaniac and possibly the most powerful man,
yeah,
in Britain until Lloyd George supplanted him a few years later. And he was campaigning through his newspapers, the Daily Mail and the Times, for conscription. And that seems to have been a very important dynamic as well.
Yeah. I mean, Northcliffe controlled the two most important papers in Britain. The Times, which was the paper of the establishment, which everybody who was anybody read. And the Daily Mail, which he had invented, he'd set up in the 1890s, and which had an enormous popular readership. So whenever Northcliffe had a policy, he could immediately bombard the masses with it through the Daily Mail, but also could bombard the people who really mattered with it. And Northcliffe was very largely responsible for the creation of the coalition in the spring of 1915. He was also largely responsible for undermining Asquith throughout 1916, to the point where Lloyd George, whom he also made and supported, could replace him in December 1916. And, I mean, Northcliffe had hated the Germans, or feared the Germans, for years. You know, back in 1905, 1906, he had a series of very bad novels serialised in the Daily Mail about the invasion of Britain by the Germans, set in the near future. And he used to go on holiday to Germany every summer and would drive around in his chauffeur-driven car and send dispatches back to his editor and his chief leader writer in London, at the Mail and at the Times, about how the Germans were forging ahead of us, how much better their schools were, how better equipped their factories were, how they looked healthier than we did. He was convinced that the Germans one day would want to attack us and make a meal of us. And so this is what, having, as he sees it, been proved right by the war happening, he's now absolutely determined that we're not going to send imbeciles to run the war, and he regards Asquith as an imbecile.
So we can loop back round to the 27th of January 1916, which is where we started this discussion of the conscription debate, which is really something of a victory for Northcliffe. This is the Military Service Act, which was introducing conscription for unmarried men between 18 and 41 from the 2nd of March. So there we go. It's a big change in the war and towards a policy of what you describe as total war. As well. This is an all-out struggle, isn't
yes.
it now?
Yes, everybody's got to play his, and indeed later on her, part. And, you know, it's unless you are a conscientious objector and you're happy, in some cases, to go to prison and be treated pretty badly in prison for it, you're going to have to go out to the Western Front and fight.
I suppose this first scene that we've been talking about is really clarified in a visual sense by the very front of your book. The Dust Jacket has got the picture of a new recruit going off in 1916 to war, presumably one of the new conscripted soldiers. And I suppose, you know, it's a scene that anyone can imagine up very quickly. You know, the goodbye at the railway station.
Actually, he was a volunteer. He joined up in, we know who he was. He's called Trooper George Wannell of the Life Guards. And he was a baker. And he's pictured on the front of my book with his wife, whom he'd only just married, who was a cake ornamenter. I presume they met at work. And the two younger girls there are her sisters, her younger sisters. There are two things that are wonderful about this picture. The first is that you see the look of both of pride and apprehension on the faces of his wife and her two little sisters. The girls were only about, 11 and 13 at the time. His wife is about 20. And Trooper Wannell, who's a very fine-looking chap in his uniform, is looking ready to go and deal with the Germans. That's the first great thing about the picture. The second great thing about it is he came home in one piece. He
wow.
survived the war. I think it would have been too depressing to put a picture on the front of one of the poor Tommies who died.
Well, a lighter note, I suppose. But this sense of enormous numbers of people being sent off to the continent is probably a good one to leave us with. So let's move on to your second scene, which is the 12th of July, 1916, in Belfast, which is the anniversary of the Battle of the Boyne. But there's something particularly poignant about this year's anniversary, isn't there?
Well, the 36th Division, the Ulster Division, which went over the top at 7:30 on the 1st of July on the Somme, 11 days earlier, was the only unit in the British Army to make all its objectives, but it did so at a tremendous cost. I can't remember the exact casualty rates, but most men were either killed or wounded. It wasn't quite as bad as some of the PALS battalions in England. Towns like Accrington and Bradford and Newcastle-on-Tyne had almost every young man there either wiped out or very badly wounded. But there were so many women, particularly, who had received letters or telegrams in the preceding days saying that their son or their husband or their brother or their father had been killed on the 1st of July. And they're milling around in Belfast all wearing black. And they all realise that they've all lost somebody. And they go and stand, I think, for 5 minutes in silence outside Belfast City Hall as an unofficial but very profound act of remembrance. And it astonishes me that society then, although allegedly human life was cheaper in those days, people were very used to having children die, Sadly, many women died in childbirth. Death was a more omnipresent thing in a family than it is now. The average life expectancy of a man was 52, I think. Nonetheless, this enormous number of deaths seems not to have destabilised society. There are stories, and I recount one or two of them in the book, at around this time in the summer of 1916, of women in towns where PALS battalions had been very badly affected, besieging newspaper offices, demanding to know what they knew. The local newspapers knew no more than they did because they were all being rationed information by the government. And it's not until really late July, early August that the newspapers start publishing these vast casualty lists. The Times in early August are publishing the names of 6,000 or 7,000 men a day who've been killed or wounded. And I still can't quite understand how society remained stable. When you think today, and I'm not diminishing this by any stretch of the imagination, but when you think today that if a single soldier, sailor or airman dies in some overseas conflict in which we're involved, it's headline news, and we all feel very strongly for their families. On the first day of the Somme, 19,240 men were killed. Another 38,000 were seriously wounded. So almost 60,000 casualties on one day. And it beggars belief that our society today could absorb that. Now, of course, in 1916, there's no broadcasting. The press is heavily censored. The news is not ever really formally issued to the public. They just have to work it out for themselves by the number of people they see walking around wearing black clothes. The fact that in the autumn of 1916, department stores start running out of black crepe cloth that women have been making their morning clothes out of. Lloyd George, when he's shown the true figures in early August 1916, and Somme, by the way, is not his fault. He wasn't Secretary of State for War when it was planned. He became Secretary of State for War 2 or 3 days after it started. But he says, my God, if this gets out, we're finished. You know, these facts are so terrible. Individual MPs start demanding to see the true figures. They're only allowed to see them after signing a declaration of secrecy. That's how catastrophic this has been. And yet it doesn't destabilise society.
I suppose today the thing that strikes me when we're thinking about Belfast on that day and the spontaneous act of remembrance that you're describing, it's kind of easy in a way for us to imagine it because we're quite familiar with mass acts of remembrance. We have them every November and at other times when there might be a significant historical anniversary as well. I don't know if you go back 100 years what tradition preceding that time there was. So I suppose there would be a rawness to it, there would be a spontaneity.
And this is entirely spontaneous. I mean, this was just people in a very tight-knit community, albeit in a quite large British city or United Kingdom city, just realising that they were all in the same boat, that they'd all lost somebody, and that death was abroad in Belfast, absolutely everywhere. It wasn't just the odd family who'd suffered, almost every family had suffered. Mm-hmm. And everybody was around shopping, and they just gathered outside the city hall as the civic focus of the town. And at midday, just stood there silently for 5 minutes and then broke up. And it's quite an astonishing thing. And I mean, the acts of remembrance that we understand now didn't come into being until after 1918, the cenotaph and the 2 minute silence. They are, of course, planned 1 year to the next, and we all know they're happening. This was entirely spontaneous, and it shows the seismic shock that went through that community as they realised just how many of their young men had been killed.
You mentioned that Lloyd George said that if this gets out, we're finished. This seems to me a constant thread throughout the book of censorship, trying to obviously propagandise what's happening in terms of the war. But, you know, there's an inevitable sense of passage of information. People are coming home at the same time. There's, I suppose, an inevitability. And again, we could maybe talk about tone in this sense. There's an idea, even if it's not put into a crisp newspaper article, that something's gone drastically wrong. And I'm wondering when, in terms of the Somme, and I think most of us know the story of that as an almost unparalleled disaster in British military history, the sheer number
absolutely
of people.
Absolutely unparalleled, yes.
Yeah, but how long did it take the British public, do you think, for that picture to clarify in their mind?
Oh, I mean, the real figures were not known until after the war. They were published very soon after the war. But it was all, if you like, anecdotal. It was all by word of mouth. It was the fact that in many communities, everybody knew several people who'd been killed. And you just looked at the casualty lists in the papers. The papers were allowed to publish casualty lists, but they weren't allowed to comment on them. So there's no Times leader saying, my God, have you seen the enormous number of people killed on the Somme last week? They just don't do it. The censor wouldn't allow it. And this is the way that the state takes over people's lives during wartime. In a state of total war, which we've got to by the summer of 1916, there's rigid control on what the press can say. And say, so it's 6 years before the birth of the BBC. The press is the only means of people getting news. Obviously, there's no internet, but there's not even any broadcasting. So once you've controlled the press, you've controlled everything. There's a film made that comes out in August 1916, made at Lloyd George's behest by some cameramen who are sent out by the War Office. And it's called The Battle of the Somme. It's on YouTube. You can
watch
it.
Is this the real Battle of the Somme, or is that a slightly different one?
No, it's called The Battle of the Somme, and right. Certain bits of footage, it's just over an hour long, I say it's on YouTube, you can look it up and find it. Of course, it's a silent film. Certain bits of footage are of real wounded Tommies. I think there's the old very badly wounded German, and it's a long time since I've seen it. But even I think a few German bodies are seen. But the cameramen were told that they could not show any British dead, anything bad happening to any British forces whatsoever. They were only to show cheerful, smiling, walking wounded Tommies at the worst. And they could show the Germans in a state of disarray and being very severely wounded. And everybody probably who's listening to this has seen at least an excerpt from this film, because it's been in every documentary I think I've ever seen on the Great War, which is that famous thing of a bunch of Tommies going over the top of the trench, and there's a chap who slides down. And this, happily for him, the chap who slid down had not been shot, he was acting. This was in a training trench several miles behind the front. They weren't allowed to go to the front. But, you know, this was all very important in August 1916, when things could have turned really ugly. The British public are shown this film, and they're shown a valiant, heroic and glorious campaign by the British, with apparently no downside, i.e. no pile of corpses. But of course it was the most murderous battle in history.
So we spoke about Belfast, which is vivid, poignant, and actually quite historically significant as we think about it. Because if you wanted to, say you wanted to write up the history of remembrance, that might well be one of the early scenes. What about the smaller towns that we spoke about with the Powell's battalions? So Accrington is famously one that suffered great, great losses. Yeah. Did you manage to find any contemporary reaction from these places in the summer of 1916? Or does it go back to that central point you made before, where you just can't believe but things carried on?
I didn't find anything really, other than an account, I think it was in Accrington, of local women besieging the newspaper office wanting information. I think people just accepted that if you went off to be a soldier, you might die. And they didn't seem to compute that people were dying in rather large numbers. I mean, it was an astonishing feat of forbearance. The real impact of this comes after the war. It comes, ironically, and I'll tell you why I say ironically in a moment, in the rise of the labour movement, because the ruling class are seen to have been responsible for this catastrophe, that they have happily sent lots of young working class men into battle to be slaughtered by machine guns. In fact, the proportion of the officer class who died in the war was significantly higher than the proportion of NCOs and other ranks. It was about 14% for the officer class and about 10% for the others. So actually the so-called ruling class took more than its share of casualties. But the end of the age of deference, if you like, is signalled by the Great War. There's so many accounts, and it's outside the scope of this book, but will be in my next volume, so many accounts of men coming back from the Great War and saying, I'm not going to be told what to do by these people anymore. And there's a direct link between that and the election of the first Labour government in 1924.
Fascinating. Well, bigger stories that lie beyond the scope of what we're talking about, because I want to finish off with our third scene, which takes us right to the end of the year. And it's on the 5th of December, 1916, when we have Cynthia Asquith, who I think is the daughter-in-law of the Prime Minister,
yeah,
having dinner with her father-in-law, and I suppose this is at number 10, and he's looking a quite worn-out, troubled, and resigned character. What's just happened?
He's resigned. he's resigned in more ways than one.
He has.
He's been confronted, I think, 5 days earlier by Lloyd George, who's had enough of what he regards as Asquith's unfocused running of the war. And Lloyd George has said to him, look, you're not up to this. What we need is a very small committee, maybe 3 or 4 people, who run this war. And I'll run that committee. You can remain as Prime Minister, but I run the war. And Asquith thinks, well, actually, maybe that's not a bad idea. And so he gives tentative agreement to Lloyd George that this would happen. And then he tells his wife, and his wife says, forget it, you're not doing that. That's the end of your career, the end of your political career. If you're not running the war, you're not effectively Prime Minister, because it's the most important thing that the country's doing. And of course she's right. So he wakes up the next morning and writes a letter to Lloyd George saying, I may have given you the impression last night that I was going to let you do this, but having slept on it, I'm not. And so Lloyd George resigns, and Bonar Law is sent for by the King as leader of the opposition, technically, and asks what he thinks about this. And he says, well, we can only really have a government if all three of us are in it, otherwise we have to have a general election, which would be very difficult to do right in the middle of a war, particularly when most of the electorate appears, because only men have the vote, are out of the country fighting. And there's then a conversation between Asquith and the King, and Bonar Law wants to run a government in which both Asquith and Lloyd George serve, and they refuse to serve with each other, and so Asquith resigns. The King asks Bonar Law if he can form a government. Bonar Law says he can't because he needs Lloyd George in it, and he says Lloyd George has got to run the government. So it ends up with the King, very reluctantly, because he doesn't like Lloyd George, sending for Lloyd George, and Lloyd George saying he'd run a government. And because Lloyd George has been very careful to cultivate support in the Conservative Party, the fact that most of his own party don't like him doesn't really count for anything. They all think he's betrayed Asquith, and he has, of course, it's a coup d'etat. But he's got enough support in the Unionist Party, and there are enough liberals who understand that, you know, it was an ugly job but someone had to do it, that he manages to form a government and keep it going for 2 years until the coupon election of 1918. And this is a real change in British society. We've used the word tone on a number of occasions. This is when the tone of government changes, and you go from the old sort of Victorian noblesse oblige ruling class government, personified by people like Lord Lansdowne, who served until the end of the Asquith coalition, Sir Edward Grey, who was a baronet from the same family as Lord Grey of the Reform Bill. People who genuinely were very high-minded and didn't go into politics in order to make a great career. I mean, Asquith was one of the most successful barristers in Britain, and he gave up a massive practice at the bar that was paying him the equivalent in today's money of several million pounds a year, just so he could be Home Secretary and just so he could serve. He wanted, you know, it was in the 1890s, he wanted to serve his country. And that tone of government, of public service, goes out the window and is replaced by Lloyd George and his cronies who come in and who start running this state more and more like a dictatorship. But Lloyd George, although he's technically a liberal, he understands that total war needs total control. He gives it a sort of dictatorial control, and he's absolutely delighted to take people that the press call new men, people from industry, and give them jobs in and around government to get things done. And these are people who would not have been given house room in any earlier administration. So the whole tone of the way the country is governed changes in December 1916.
You've got a quote from Duff Cooper, which I thought was instructive. And he was friends with Raymond Asquith, the son. And he recalled the father, the old barrister, maybe we should think of him as, belonging to the Victorian age. He would have thought it ill-bred to discuss current politics at the dinner table or to criticise other politicians. Yes. He was, as you describe really well, someone who took no trouble really to secure his own position. Yeah. And he could have probably built up his personal reputation. And then the contrast with him and Lloyd George is quite stark. Yeah. You get this very canny operator full of energy and dynamism. Yes. He's going to, I don't know if it's, I don't know how useful parallels are
in this case. But we spoke to Andrew Roberts about Churchill when he came in May 1914. It was a complete change. One day you have this kind of fusty old government with Chamberlain. The next day you have this punchy one with Churchell. And that can happen with politics, can't it?
Well, Churchill very much modelled what he did with what Lloyd George did in December 1916.
Yeah.
But what was really shocking about this was this is the Liberal Party has only existed since the Reform Act, for then they were Whigs. And this is the first time a Liberal leader has ever been thrown out because Lord John Russell went of his own accord. Gladstone retired at the age of 83, couldn't go on any longer. Rosebery just had enough and walked out. Campbell Bannerman ate and drank himself to death and died in 1908. So Asquith is the fifth leader of the Liberal Party in its modern
form. I know, but it seems like, from reading through it, sounds like it's been a long time coming from him. He could have easily gone a year earlier, couldn't he? I think there's one point when he woke up in the night and went into his wife's bedroom and said, I've had enough, I'm going. And you've got people like Edward Carson saying it's a system of governing by 22 gabblers around a table with an old procrastinator in the chair. This is the kind of...
Asquith was largely his own worst enemy, but it was perhaps unfortunate for Britain in the long term, that he was replaced by Lloyd George and not by Bonar Law, who I think would have done very much the same things as Lloyd George did, but without soiling public life in the way that Lloyd George did. I mean, Lloyd George monumentally in 1918 lies to Parliament in the Morris debate and in the statement that provokes the Morris debate about the numbers of soldiers he's allowed to be sent to France. And he thinks nothing of getting up in the House of Commons and telling a blatant lie. Now, you know, this may be par for the course today, but why is it par for the course today? Because Lloyd George started it.
Wow. I think that change of premiership, if I can use that language, is probably quite a good way to leave this suspended, because I think, I don't know, if you look back at it, I think there was a general sense that Asquith had to go at this point. And your question probably remains with, was he replaced with the right person?
Yeah.
But maybe that's, well, one of the good things with history, it's always nice to leave questions hanging in the air and we can imagine different realities, and maybe the rest of the war would have played out very differently. We've gone right through 1916 and now we're back in 2019 in a random house in Vauxhall looking out the window of a nice skyline. If you could have one object back in this modern reality from 1916, a tangible thing that would remind you of that time, what would you like to have?
A Tommy. I'd like a real British soldier sitting in this room with us, sort of 19 or 20 years old, who's just done a couple of years on the Western Front to tell us what it was really like.
Wow.
I mean, I'm old enough to have known some men who did that, but then they were in old age when I knew them. But to have someone who's actually, you know, of an age where you might have to go back to it again, that's what I'd most like, because we've got endless documentaries, there are endless books on the military side. As you correctly say, this book I've written is not a military history, although, because it's about largely about high politics, the movement of troops and strategy comes into it a lot. But to understand what it was really like, you'd have to sit down and talk to one of those men. And of course, many of them didn't talk for decades, partly because they didn't want to revisit the memories, partly because they didn't think anyone would understand. Anyone would comprehend what it was like to stand, you know, for 2 weeks at a time, up to your knees in mud, looking at rotting corpses, having Germans firing at you. And for many of them, it was a truly awful time. I mean, some people relished it, and some people made friendships that lasted for decades afterwards. And it was a tremendous bonding experience, and a tremendous shared experience for them. But I'd like to have a Tommy here and just talk to him about what it was really like.
Well, that's perfectly put. Lots of voices in your book from right across British society. It's a tremendous research project. You've given us so much to think about today, so much to ponder. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today, Simon. Thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure for me. Thank you.
So there we leave Simon Heffer with plenty to ponder as our week of remembrance begins. His book, Staring at God, Britain in the Great War, has recently been published in hardback by Random House Books. Thank you very much for listening.
I'm Paul Lay, the editor of History Today. You can read more about the year 1916 www.historytoday.com/travel-through-time. There, you'll find Gary Sheffield asking whether the Battle of the Somme was just an exercise in futility. Rebecca Pine, Edwards Banks, looks at conscription. while Alice Brumby considers how former soldiers return to civilian life. All this and more can be found in the pages of History Today, the world's leading serious history magazine. To subscribe, go to www.historytoday.com.